Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
The 2012 election is history, and the next chapter begins for President Barack Obama and a split Congress. Welcome to Virginia Conversations. I'm Maylily Lee. Thanks for joining us. This year's election will go down in history as the most expensive ever, with candidates spending an estimated $6 billion, enough to bankroll 1 million presidential ads aired between June 1st and the end of October. The Huffington Post points out that's enough to buy 4 billion batteries for powerless victims of Superstorm Sandy, to pay the mortgage this month for 6 million Americans. 6 billion would prevent 4 million deaths from malaria. You get the picture. After all that spending, we're in a place that looks like where we started, with Democrats controlling the White House and Senate, and Republicans holding the House. So what could possibly change? Sandy Houseman talked with one historian who shares some insight.
They disagreed about nearly everything during the campaign, but on election night, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama had one thing in common, a belief in collaboration.
The nation, as you know, is at a critical point. At a time like this, we can't risk partisan bickering and political posturing. Our leaders have to reach across the aisle to do the people's work.
I am looking forward to reaching out and working with leaders of both parties to meet the challenges we can only solve together.
But how to achieve agreement? That's the question. At the Miller Center's Presidential Oral History Program, Senior Fellow Barbara Perry says the president should keep campaigning for public support and start socializing in private.
The president will be going to the Hill to meet with people. He'll probably be bringing people to the White House. Doris Kearns Goodwin last night on Charlie Rose said the president should be bringing folks from the Hill to Camp David. In other words, socializing with them and do the sorts of outreach that Lyndon Johnson did so well.
Of course, Barack Obama is no Lyndon Johnson.
He has said not to like schmoozing, not to like the arm twisting that Lyndon Johnson did. My sense is he could do it if he put his mind to it.
Perry says previous presidents have found points of agreement with their opponents. Those who wouldn't go for comprehensive health care reform, for example, could be convinced to provide coverage for children. And a crisis like the financial meltdown in 2008 often prompts opponents to act as allies. But presidents should get an early start on controversial measures. Perry points to George W. Bush, who waited too long to call for Social Security and immigration reform.
At the beginning of his second term, he's facing Katrina in 2005 in that summer, and we know that that goes badly for him, and he loses a lot of the political capital that he had gained in his reelection in 2004, which I think is an important lesson for our current president to keep in mind.
And it would be easier for Obama to appoint the people he wants to the Supreme Court before 2014. But, of course, he may not control the timing.
Who can say about what openings might develop? We're only going by actuarial tables. And what, in the case of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she has said, which is, we know she's 79 years old. We also know that she's had two rounds of cancer, but that she seems to be going strong at the current time. She has said she'd like to go to age 82 to meet her hero, Louis Brandeis, who retired from the court at 82. So if that's the case, she would indeed retire during an Obama presidency. But it wouldn't be until after the next round of Senate elections, in which a third of the Senate will be up again. If they should lose the Senate, that could be problematic for the president.
In addition to watching the president, Professor Perry's keeping an eye on three congressional leaders. She thinks House Speaker John Boehner might be empowered to take more moderate positions by Tea Party losses in the last election. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has implied he will not compromise on the question of paring down debt without raising taxes. But Perry thinks he might come around if it'll help him get reelected in 2014.
He may be challenged, by the way. I've been hearing Ashley Judd's name floated for the Kentucky Senate seat, so wouldn't that be an interesting contest?
As for House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who's clashed with President Obama on the debt ceiling and budget cuts, Barbara Perry isn't sure.
He must be taking stock in the Old Dominion, knowing that it went for Obama, that Tim Kaine won, that the Tea Party took hits. Nevertheless, Eric Cantor has his personality, so I wouldn't be surprised to see almost a good cop, bad cop relationship going between Boehner as the good cop and Cantor continuing to play the bad cop role.
One thing the president has going for him in the first big negotiation to prevent across-the-board budget cuts from kicking in, Virginia is heavily dependent on defense spending, and cuts to the Pentagon will hit hard in Eric Cantor's backyard. What's more, allowing the nation to go off the fiscal cliff might push us back into recession, a development that could make both sides look bad. I'm Sandy Houseman.
Our guests will be following whether or not a new spirit of cooperation prevails in Washington. They are Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Jeff Skelly, political analyst for the University of Virginia Center for Politics, who joins us from the Charlottesville studio of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, and Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And we want to thank all of you for being here. Let's just get a hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great. And you can join the conversation by calling our toll-free number. We invite listeners to join in the dialogue at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. Anita, I'd like to start with you. It's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. You know, partisanship is as old as the hills.
That's right. And, today is actually a big day. The president's going to give his first comments about the fiscal cliff today, and the Speaker of the House is also going to talk. So we're going to get a good idea of how willing they are to sort of compromise or if they're going to stand where they were before the election.
Jeff, what about your coverage? I know that what's great about your organization and Bob's is these are think tanks and learning and teaching institutions. So from an educational perspective, what do we have to look forward to here?
Well, I guess we have a chance to see if it's possible in this very polarized era for two parties to come together to figure out how to meet what is a very extreme challenge. One side has to be willing to compromise over a no tax increases position, and the other has to be willing to reform things that it created, entitlement programs that it was the main creator of, the Democratic Party. So I guess we'll kind of just see how that has to play out. I'm both hopeful and cynical about it.
And Bob, can you dovetail off of what Jeff's saying?
Well, I think it's also a game of expectations. And one good thing is that they have a very low bar to look good. Both sides already look pretty bad in the eyes of the public, certainly in the Congress. And if they cooperate more than people expect them to, they may find that they're getting higher marks than they had previously received.
I remember being at a polling district where I spoke with one of the very localized candidates. This was, you know, the level of a board of education seat, that type of thing. And I was handed a flyer. And I said, well, now there are five names on this flyer. Can you break this down for me? Which ones are the Democrats and which ones are the Republicans? And he said, well, that's the point, is we're all mixed, and we're all actually supporting each other because we are together on this one issue. And I was really pleased to see that at the local level, but it seems like it can be a political suicide at the congressional level, at the Senate level, for anyone to do anything other than toe the party line.
Oh, definitely. You have to think about it. If you're a conservative Republican, but you're not a Tea Party Republican, and you're say Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, or any other kind of mainline conservative senator, you risk a challenge in a primary on your next election if you are seen as too compromising on important conservative issues. So it's the same on the left as well. So it's kind of a dangerous game you play when you compromise. We all want them to compromise, but their political futures could be on the line.
We're recovering from Superstorm Sandy. How much of an impact will this have? I know the timing here is very different than the Katrina timing in the Bush administration, but what kind of role could Superstorm Sandy play in this administration? Who wants to take that? Anita?
Sure. Well, I think it's already played a role. It's mostly played a role in politics so far. You're seeing a lot of Republicans after the election say that it really did a lot of good in the last week of the campaign for President Obama. He got to look very presidential. He got to look like the commander-in-chief, and that, you know, you saw Republicans actually praising him. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was out there praising him. And so that may have helped him. You saw there were some reports that Governor Romney said that, actually, to some of his supporters, that he thought that his momentum stalled. But now that the election is over, you know, these things are a long haul. We tend to, in other parts of the country, when you're not involved, you tend to think, well, it's for a day or a week. But actually, I mean, this is months and months of recovery that the Northeast is going to need. A lot of people are still without power. So a lot of people are going to be looking at how President Obama handles this going forward, even though there's not an election happening right around the corner. So far, though, he's gotten pretty good marks.
We've learned a few things during this particular election, and you know, there are some folks who are extremely disappointed at the outcome. There are other folks who are hopeful, and yet the actual process of going through these elections taught a few lessons. One I might toss to you, Bob, is that we learned that the polls tended to be right on, that there were different camps who claimed that polls were misleading or polls were inaccurate, but for the most part it turned out that what the polls said were pretty darn close to fact.
The polls were fairly accurate. There had been an attempt to attack and besmirch the polls during the campaign, but you know, the polls were not predictive and should not be seen as being predictive, but when you take them over time and they show an average over time, you can follow a trend line. And the trend line was fairly accurate in terms of showing where they ended up on November 6th on Tuesday. So I think the polls, despite the difficulties that pollsters have with cell phones and other people they can't contact or who won't call them back if they leave a message, they did an amazingly good job. We just put too much stock in polls when we are covering a race, I think. There are other things that are more important.
Jeff, I want to talk about another lesson. I'm holding the Roanoke Times from yesterday, and it talks about a mix of factors leading to the long voting line. Some people had to wait 2 hours or longer, particularly in this region. And here's what the sub-headline says. Lines are being attributed to turnout, new technology, inexperienced poll workers, and other causes. So whenever there is a challenge to voting, it makes it problematic for voters to do what they're supposed to be doing, and it makes it tough on voters to get out and actually cast their ballot.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think actually what happened on Election Day to a certain extent was very embarrassing for the country. You know, we're a democracy. People shouldn't have to take large chunks out of their day. I mean, a lot of people, you know, they have to go to work. They have, you know, children. They have all kinds of things they need to be, you know, deal with in their average day of their lives. And somehow other democracies are able to get people through lines to vote in reasonable amounts of time, yet in the United States, just kind of by random luck and chance, depending on where you are, might have taken you 15 minutes to vote on Tuesday, or it might have taken you 4 hours. And that's just absurd in the 21st century.
The number to call is 866-611-NEWS. Join in the dialogue at 866-611-6397. What were your experiences at the polls, we might ask you? Also, chime in about how you feel about the continued administration. And, you know, Anita, we talked briefly, and I know that there is much more here as well around just the ability to get out and vote. And Virginia is not one of the top states. Of 35 states that allow early voting, Virginia is not one of them.
Right. Virginia actually offers, you know, in-person absentee is what they call it. So there's 20 or so reasons you might be able to vote early. But I don't think a lot of people take advantage of that. I mean, you can only go to certain places and you have to have one of these reasons. Now, the reasons are a variety. I mean, you can, particularly in Northern Virginia, this might affect you. You could say you work in a different jurisdiction than you live, and that's a reason. And, you know, with a lot of people working in D.C., that might work. You know, you're not going to be home, you're ill, you care for someone who's ill. So those are reasons, but we are, you know, in Virginia, not a big place for in-person absentee. This year, a lot of places, you know, including Virginia, looked at changing their voting rules, and I think Virginia perpetually looks every year, the General Assembly takes a consideration of whether there should be early voting. And Republicans in the House of Delegates are just opposed to that, and it has died year after year. I suspect it'll come up again, and it'll die again. They did change voting here in Virginia and many other states to require an identification. I'm wondering if that has something to do with some of the long lines. Several states now require different ID than they used to, or an additional ID.
You know, for the first time in 25 years as a Virginia resident, I applied for, on time, an absentee ballot. And I went through all kinds of hoops, heard conflicting information about what I was to do and not do, and in the end, I was not allowed to vote in Virginia. It was disheartening, and I thought that if it was difficult for me, how many other people it must have been difficult for. Paul from Charlottesville, go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, I think since most of the polls are basically paid for by localities that, for example, I was in Albemarle. We have plenty of voting machines. It seems to be very smooth. They're very modern. We get in, we go through it. It's not a problem. But I think that the budget cuts that have happened in the last couple of years, the localities haven't been able to keep up. And really, it's a local responsibility. And I think that between the budget cuts and whatnot, the localities are simply not putting the money into it.
Jeff, do you have a response to Paul's comment?
Yes. No, I think that makes perfect sense. The responsibility for administering voting in this country is from state to state and thus gets put down at the local level. So kind of depending on the circumstances of each locality, you know, he says that it went fairly well in Albemarle. Albemarle's a fairly prosperous area, whereas, you know, maybe a poorer area, perhaps they had less voting machines and less polling places. And it's just kind of it's very haphazard, just because in one place it can go very well and in other places it can't.
Thanks, Paul, for your question. Bob, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I know the election officials in Charlottesville and Albemarle were very well trained, and we're ready for just about any contingency that might have happened on Tuesday. And yet there were lines at the polls in places in Albemarle up to an hour or two. And I agree with Jeff. It is an embarrassment for our country to have 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 hours of waiting to exercise this basic right, which is why I think in the Congress we will see a push to push the states, and the states would have to push the localities to do better.
How many times do we hear the shifting of blame? The Board of Elections will blame the localities. The localities will blame the Board of Elections. Is this common from state to state?
Very common. We have a system that requires different things of all levels of government, and we have in bad economic times, a tendency to push problems down. The federal government pushes more responsibilities and paying for them on the states sometimes. The states do that to the localities and in a tight budget. So we end up with the localities having to put the bill for something that originated elsewhere.
We are talking with Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Jeff Skelly, Political Analyst for the University of Virginia Center for Politics, and Anita Kumar, White House Correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We'll have more on the results of Tuesday's election and beyond in just a moment, but next week we're talking turkey. What was on the holiday menu for Virginia's early colonists? That's coming up next Friday on Virginia Conversations. In the meantime, stay with us. We're back in just a minute.
Hi, 19. Thanks for joining us for Virginia Conversations on WVTF Radio IQ, where support comes from Floyd's Harvest Moon Food Store, 30 years of providing local foods, natural products, and gifts. Website harvestmoonfoods.com. Today's day sponsor is Voice of the Blue Ridge, providing services for the visually impaired. Details and volunteer information at vobr.org or 540-985-8900. Look for lots of sunshine on this Friday with highs around 62. A clear sky tonight, lows most areas around 32. For the Stanton-Charlottesville area, near 38. More sunshine for tomorrow, highs most areas around 70. For Fredericksburg, approaching 65. And on Sunday, sunny with highs around 70.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today we're discussing the 2012 election. Our guests are Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Jeff Skelly, Political Analyst for the University of Virginia Center for Politics, and Anita Kumar, White House Correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. You can join our conversation by calling our toll-free number, 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. On Tuesday, Latino support for Democrats helped tip the scales in Virginia. Exit polling suggests Latinos voted 2-1 for President Obama. With his margin of victory in Virginia just over 100,000 votes, analysts say Latinos may have provided the edge. Robbie Harris has more.
The Latino population in Virginia has nearly doubled in the last 10 years, mostly in the northern part of the Commonwealth. Virginia Tech political science professor Javier Medina Vidal says both parties reached out to Latinos here, but Republicans relied on an old strategy, appealing to core traditional values.
The Latino population doesn't look the way it did 20 or 30 years ago, and the Republican Party is still believes that it looks that way. It's a much more heterogeneous group, and what matters to the Latino population is substance. So a realistic conversation about immigration, about jobs and health care and education is what this country needs.
By contrast, Democrats in Virginia drew a clear line in the sand on what's considered a top issue of concern to the Latino community, support for immigration reform, not only in the presidential race, but also in the tight race for Senate, and there, too, voters returned the favor. Former Virginia Governor, now Senator-elect Tim Kaine, gave voice and this nod to his Latino supporters.
It is a great night to be a Virginian.
I'm Robbie Harris.
Somos Virginianos todos.
Jeff Skelly, we'll start with you. This is a shift. Historically, the Latino vote is something that Romney could have counted on. What's going on here?
Well, in the last, since 2000, actually, the Latino vote has gone more sharply for the Democratic Party, but the real difference now is that they make up, exit polls showed that in this past, just the election on Tuesday, that they were 1 in 10 voters nationally. And that you know, if they're going 71-27 nationally for the Democrat in a presidential election, that's a huge percentage of a tenth of the vote. And that can make the real difference. It made the difference probably in Florida and Colorado, two states with large Latino populations that, where they supported the president by a very high rate.
Victor from Cape Charles and Sam from Roanoke, hold on just a moment with your calls and your questions. I do want to continue along the lines of this Latino discussion. Anita, do you concur with what Jeff's pointing out here, historically speaking, this shift that's going on?
I do, but I do think in the last, as he said, the last few elections, they have voted more Democratic than Republican. I think what happened was last time there was a huge Latino vote. I think in 2008 they had estimated it was about 9%, and this year about 10%. So it's slowly going up. I think a lot of people thought that 2008 was a fluke in a lot of ways, that Obama got a lot of young voters out. He got women, he got gay voters, he got Latinos, African Americans, but that it was a one-time deal, that he was this, you know, he had this wonderful message of hope and change, first African American president, and that those numbers wouldn't come out again. And I think what you saw was supporters and critics thought, well, you know, people are less enthusiastic, you know, they're not as excited to vote this time, no matter who you are. And what happened was they realized this year sort of solidified it was, no, this is the new Democratic Party. These are coalitions that are going to be part of the Democratic Party unless the Republicans can figure out a way to sort of attract them. So I think this is how we're going to see things going forward.
Bob Gibson, your thoughts.
Well, not only do we have a new Democratic Party, in part, we have a new Virginia. Most people have an image in their mind of the state of Virginia that is somewhat in the past instead of exactly the demographics we have today. Half of all Virginians were born outside the state and brought their political predispositions with them from elsewhere. 1 in 10 Virginians today, 1 in 10 registered voters today, was born in a foreign country. Four in ten of those foreign-born are Latino. Four in ten of those foreign-born are Asian Americans. And, you know, that's not a Virginia that everyone has yet firmly planted in their mind, and I think the Republican Party squandered the Latino vote and pushed it away.
All three of you, call me on this if this is too broad a statement. It seems that voters can vote down one of two major lines. One is their economic reality or the economic reality at large. The second is a social agenda, civil rights, social justice. Those seem to be two big categories in which voters will pull that lever. And is that happening, and is that also why it's difficult to say how a voter might turn?
You could look at it that way and say that that's how voters decide their vote, but I don't think voters generally think in terms of issues. I think they think in terms of likability. They think in terms of who would be better for them, without thinking of a specific issue or a set of issues. You know, it's more visceral than that. So I don't think you can neatly break the vote down on people's responses to issue questions on polls.
Okay. We want to take this call from Victor from Cape Charles. You're our first, Victor. We've not yet had a listener call in from Cape Charles. Beautiful out there. You want to talk about your wait at the polls?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I work at the polls here in Cape Charles. Our problem was that the number of machines, voting machines available, or the number of workers. The problem was the three Virginia state constitutional amendments that was written in a print by the state of Virginia. These amendments were not easily understood by majority of the voters, and some of them did not want to read it because it confused them the most, not understanding what the amendments were all about. And on top of that, the most questions asked by the voters were, is my yes vote is a yes or no? It was very confusing. And when they came to voting machine, the officials had to explain to them one amendment at a time, over and over again, and that delayed the voting time and added to the lines more people coming and voting. So people who voted for presidential or the Senate or the Congress, they had no problem casting their votes. But when they came on these three amendments, they had most difficulty because the way it was written, it was good for someone with a higher education. Even with a college education, they had to read two or three times.
Okay, well, I'll be the first to go there, okay? are these deliberately made difficult? We talk about conspiracy theories, and Lord knows you lose a lot of credit when you begin to go down that path. But why would they be made difficult? Why wouldn't someone be working hard to make these ballots easy to understand for everybody? Anita?
I have to. I'm glad he brought that up because we hadn't brought that up, and I totally agree. Talked to a lot of people who you know, had to read that amendment, particularly there's one in particular I'm talking about that deals with property rights many, many times. I don't think it was a deliberate, you know, I think it's legalese. It's going into the Constitution. They probably wrote it the best they could. Remember, this was passed by a divided General Assembly. So, you know, we have Democrats on the Senate side, Republicans on the House side. They had to agree on that. It got on the ballot. I do think it's confusing, and I know a lot of people probably did do what he did or what he said other people did, which is read it several times. The reality is that was a confusing amendment. It did pass overwhelmingly, and I kind of, when I saw that, I kind of wondered people even know what they were voting for. So I do agree on some levels. I don't think that it was purposely done, though.
We have another call. Thank you so much, Victor, by the way. We have another call from Roanoke. Sam, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to touch base with what Victor talked about. But broaden it a little bit is that, you know, they spent like $6 billion on this election campaign. They couldn't spend any of that money on public service announcements to, you know, educate the voters how to use the machines. Because when I got there, I kind of got through pretty quick, but it was pretty troubling for some of the elderly voters there. And I think that if they could take the time to either have some sort of event where people can come out and learn how to use them or, you know, put something on them, TV ads about it, it would be very beneficial.
Sam, we read that excerpt from the Roanoke Times. How long did you have to wait?
I only waited like 10 minutes. I live out in Botetourt.
Great.
But, you know, I was talking with a coworker, and he said he had to wait like 40 minutes. And I'm not sure where he voted.
Yeah. Thank you for that call. And we've got another call from Virginia Beach. Kenny, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Two quick things. One, in my neighborhood in Virginia Beach, we had three polling places within a 3-mile radius. But then my mother-in-law in another section of Virginia Beach with more population only had one. But let's get to the real thing. The real thing is the Republicans, it's not a conspiracy theory. It is the truth. For the last 20 years, the language, the politics, and getting in people's personal lives, splitting the population by race, by income, and keep saying they're jealous because someone make more money. No, we're working hard out here, and we're not making any money. For the last 20 years, wages have actually, not theoretically, have went down. That's why they're busting unions. And they're getting rich off of this, shipping money overseas. And people is tired. And gerrymandering, messing with the people voted. You know, we're all Americans, and every Republican state changed their voting law. Let's talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny. Bob Gibson, do you want to take that?
Well, state legislatures have a lot of power in this process, and Virginia's is divided, but, you know, we do have a history of making things harder than they have to be at the polls. I think voting should be easy, it should be quick, and, you know, the issues that Kenny is talking about are issues that were echoed through the campaign. People made up their minds well in advance of Tuesday. If there had been easy early voting in Virginia, I think there would not have been lines, and I think those questions could have been handled as people went to vote at their own convenience rather than, you know, and there are European countries that vote over a long weekend. We don't have to have people waiting in line for 6 hours stewing over the fact that their wages haven't gone up if they could vote a month early.
The number is 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. We invite you to take part in this dialogue. Share with us your opinions, your experiences, and more. And we can come back to some of the voter experiences. However, I do want to address something that is leading up to Election Day. We were barraged with television and radio ads and other forms of campaigning. Barraged, literally, and some people just became so turned off to the messaging. My experience was that it seemed like toward the end there were lots of Romney ads. But, Anita, you had a different experience.
Well, I mean, I wasn't home. I got to tell you, I was traveling a lot, so I wasn't here watching TV. But my sense when I did and my sense from other people is there were a lot of ads for everybody or against everyone, I should say. So there were Democratic, you know, Barack Obama, Tim Kaine ads, Mitt Romney, George Allen on the other side. I just felt like there were just so many ads, I mean, just in general. And, of course, the reason for that this year is in Virginia as well as other places, there were so many other outside groups that contributed. Supreme Court decision a few years ago allowed that to happen, and it was unlimited spending, basically. And so people in the, you know, 6 or 10 swing states really got inundated with television ads.
Jeff, do you want to add to that?
She's exactly right in the sense that everyone was doing it. I mean, when you're 4 days out from the election and there's 7 commercials during the commercial break of what, a football game you're watching, and I'm saying this from personal experience, and all 7 are political ads in some form, I mean, it's going to grow tiresome to people who don't follow this for a living. I mean, it was tiresome for me, and I look at this stuff for a living. So I can understand how people became very, very sick of the process early on because, I mean, these ads have been running for months in Virginia because Virginia was a key swing state. And I think there's going to be a big debate on the effectiveness of ads when you reach a certain kind of tipping point where you have the return on your investment with these ads has to fall. I mean, the margin of return has to fall over time because people have heard the same thing so many times that they've tuned out from what's being talked about. And I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about just what is the maximum efficiency of television advertising?
Bob Gibson.
I would agree with both, and I think we have an opportunity through early voting to mitigate the barrage of ads at the end. If every state had 6 weeks of you can vote at your own time at a central voting place, and you wouldn't have to stand in line for more than 15 minutes, I think the ad distribution would be very changed, and we would see less of this kind of massive spending on turn-off ads, and probably a little less of the attack ads, although the attack ads still work, and that's why I push the mute button every time I'm watching a football game.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations. Our number is 866-611-NEWS, 866-611-6397. Hayes from Charlottesville, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having this conversation. I guess I have a simple question with maybe a very complicated answer. You know, I spend most of my day in front of a computer, and I understand that that's not everyone's experience, but is there any discussion of the possibility of voting over the Internet or voting from home rather than having to go to a central polling place?
If we do, Virginia will be the last the last state to offer it.
It'll be interesting to see how that works for Sandy victims, victims of the storm who were allowed to vote electronically or fax in their ballots. There was a lot of confusion over how that might work, and I don't know how well it worked or if it worked well at all. But there will be people looking at that. And technology is constantly changing. So, you know, it's difficult to write a law that is going to apply uniformly, evenly, and fairly over a period of time.
Well, I can remember in my senior year, my AP government class, talking about the idea of Internet voting. So I think there's been discussion of this in the past and present and will be in the future. And I think there'll probably be some interesting academic papers written about the experience in New Jersey and New York, I guess. Well, New Jersey in this storm, and actually emailing to ask for your ballot and returning it by email if you could scan it. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I think at the moment we're ways away from seeing that happen.
Susan from Hampton and Dana from Roanoke, continue to hold as we round out this discussion here. Please stay with us. Anita, do you have a feeling that there would be just as much issue with miscounts and misrepresentation of the votes?
If there was email voting or
online
voting?
Email and online, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how that would work, actually. I mean, until the Sandy victims were allowed to do that, I had not heard any real discussion of that. I think we're away from that, and I do agree with you. You know, even if some other states try to look at it, I think Virginia is way away from that. I mean, Virginia, as you indicated, doesn't even have early voting. So the fact that they would move on to that seems really unrealistic in the near future. I think no matter what kind of voting you have, there's always going to be some sort of dispute. You know, people wonder, did their vote really count? Did it really register? How did they count it? I think that's just the way we are. You know, at my polling place, I voted in Virginia. They had so many people there that they pulled out the regular paper ballots. I don't remember the last time I saw one of those. I actually didn't remember how to do it. This is when you color in the little circle. And there were people there confused. How will the machine read my paper ballot? So no matter what it is, you think you're going back to basics and it'll be okay. People were sort of confused by that and wondering.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Hayes and Susan, stay with us. Your calls are next. This reminder, past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. We're back with more on Tuesday's election in just a minute.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on WVTF Radio IQ. Good morning, and thanks for being with us. Support is provided by Davidson's, a hometown company offering business and casual clothing for men, including custom-made since 1910. Davidson's, downtown and Electric Road. And SFCS Architects and Engineers, blending the natural environment with the built environment for more than 80 years. SFCS.com. Looks like a beautiful weekend on tap. Lots of sunshine for this Friday with highs around 62. Clear tonight, lows most areas around 32. For the Staten-Charlottesville area, near 38. It'll be sunny again tomorrow. Highs most areas around 70. For Fredericksburg, approaching 65. And more sunshine for Sunday. Highs once again around 70. It's 9:40.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today we're discussing the results of the 2012 election. Our guests are Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership, Jeff Skelly, Political Analyst for the University of Virginia Center for Politics, and Anita Kumar, White House Correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. You can join our conversation by calling our toll-free number, 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. Before we go to our next story, I want to take your call, Susan. You're from Hampton.
Good morning. You had asked for observations by voters on their voting experience on Election Day, and I applied for an absentee ballot on October 1st, and to this day I still haven't received one, but I did call the registrar's office, and I was able to go in and vote absentee in person.
Right. And don't you just love that when they tell you you can vote absentee in person? It's such a conundrum.
Well, it is a hassle because then you have to, you know, find your way to the registrar's office. But, you know, the staff there was fantastic, and they made it easy for me. I'm just frustrated for myself and for other voters, especially when I heard you say that you were not able to vote in Virginia because you did not receive your absentee ballot.
Yep. I did everything I could, too.
I was also a volunteer for the Obama campaign as a voter advocate inside the polling place on Election Day. I just have to say that the precinct workers were incredible. Any person who had any difficulty at all, they met them where they were to make sure that their vote was counted. And at least in Hampton, at the John Smith precinct, I have nothing but tremendous admiration for those poll workers who were there at 5 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, and they made sure that every person was treated with respect, that the laws were followed, and that the votes were counted.
Thank you so much, Susan. I appreciate that. We have another call from Dana from Roanoke, also relating to absentee voting. Go ahead, Dana.
Good morning, everybody. I'm calling right when I got into the car. I heard someone say that they were denied the opportunity to vote because their absentee ballot wasn't received. And I'm vice president of the Virginia Electoral Board Association. I just wanted to clarify exactly how that had happened because it really shouldn't, except in perhaps some really extreme circumstances. But at minimum, you should have been given the opportunity for a provisional ballot. And the provisional vote then would have been your affirmation that you should be allowed to vote, that you had not already cast an absentee ballot. Then the canvas of the election at that point is supposed to determine the accuracy and ensure that you were one qualified to vote, and two, that had not attempted to vote twice. But you should have at least been given that opportunity, if I have understood correctly what happened.
Right, and thank you for that input from Roanoke. I appreciate that. My experience was in Richmond, and I went to every possible avenue I could have. I spoke to officials at the State Board of Elections. I spoke to the local registrar in Richmond. It started with Richmond because that's where the Board of Board of Elections directed me. They said, let the local locality handle this issue for you. I called and called. Occasionally, I would be lucky enough to get through to a real person. And my last call was when someone said, we will be sending you an email explaining further steps, explaining this or that. I never received that email that was promised. So while there is, and no one ever suggested to vote provisionally, I was going to be an absentee voter. It meant I was not going to be around. I was not going to be in state. So I understand that there are processes in place. It just felt to me like there are some communication issues, too, that get in the way of that process. We have another call from Ben from Chesapeake. Go ahead with your call.
Yes, I was just calling in regards to the advertising that you guys were talking about just a moment ago. One of the things that I noticed is an observation and then kind of a quick question regarding it. My family is probably in the upper 5% of economic brackets, and just as an observation, the only phone calls we ever received were all from Crossroads GPS, the Republican National Committee, and so forth, which I thought was interesting. But then on top of that, despite my phone number being on the do not call list, I received probably 2 to 3 phone calls in the evening for the 2 weeks prior to the election. And I'm curious, you know, how does that all play into it? How are these organizations getting phone numbers for folks that really don't want to be called if we're registering on these do not call lists?
Thanks for your call, Ben. Bob, Jeff, or Anita, anyone want to take it?
I think the do not call list is a good idea, and it works occasionally with commercial messages, but I don't think it applies in political campaigns.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Let's take Jonathan's call from Giles County. Jonathan?
Yeah. I live out here in Giles, and what kind of frightens me, I had 2 incidents, one right before the election and then one the night of the election where I actually had to break up a fight between some really loud and boisterous people who were frustrated with the results of both the presidential election and some local issues. And what frightens me is that when these people have exhausted the political means to resolve issues, they seem willing to result to violence, and they're angry. And I'd just like to see how the speakers see that playing out in some of these areas where there's a lot of angry, frustrated people that feel like the political process, they're on the losing side of history, and the political process isn't working for them, and they're willing to take whatever means are necessary.
What do you think, Anita, Jeff?
Yeah, I didn't quite catch. Was it supporters or actual volunteers and workers that were getting overly excited there?
Jonathan, are you still with us?
Oh, he's gone. Well, I mean, I guess I would just say that, I mean, as this election showed, the country's divided. I mean, you can look, you know, President Obama won overwhelmingly when you look at the Electoral College vote. But when you look at the popular vote, I don't know, it wasn't that far off. I mean, people are really divided. People are really frustrated. If you look at the Congress, they have maybe an 11% approval rating right about now. They can't seem to get much done. I think they've had passed fewer bills than the previous Congresses in the last 6 decades. I mean, there are a lot of strong feelings. Now, I didn't see anyone get into any fights, but I did hear a lot of heated discussions about things. And I think, you know, this next 4 years, or especially the next 2 years before the next election, is going to really, you know, the Democrats and Republicans really have to show whether they can get anything done. That's been sort of the frustration, is that they are fighting so much in Washington.
Pundits may have been surprised when Virginia went blue on campaign maps, but at least 2 researchers at the University of Virginia saw it coming. Sandy Hausman has this report on how they knew the Commonwealth would stay in President Obama's camp. Let's have a listen.
Last summer, Michelle Claiborne and Dustin Cable, research associates at the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service, issued a report suggesting Virginia was in transition from its historical red roots to a blue state. The reason? Increasing diversity in our population. Claiborne says Hispanics and Asians, including people from India and Pakistan, are a growing part of the population in Northern Virginia.
Those groups seem to have come out, and to come out with as strong or stronger margins for Obama in 2012 compared to 2008.
And African Americans did not waver in their support for the president. They make up about 20% of the state's population, and that has not changed much. But more of them are taking part in elections.
2008 turnout among blacks was historic in Virginia. It actually matched that of whites. And the fact that that might happen again in 2012, and again we'll have to look at the numbers in greater detail, is truly a historic event in the political history of Virginia.
You know, voting is a habit. Once you start voting once, especially twice, the chances that you are now a more regular voter, and to the extent the composition changes because the Democratic Party managed to bring in new voters, that can have longer term consequences for elections for decades to come.
At the same time, Cable says some communities that were solidly Republican have begun to splinter.
The numbers for Romney coming out of Chesterfield County, which is mostly a white suburb of the Richmond metro area, were not looking good for Romney. He needed to have larger margins in Chesterfield County.
And finally, the youth vote again went strongly for Obama, leading Claiborne and Cable to conclude that 2008 was not a fluke, that Virginia really is changing its political course. I'm Sandy Houseman.
Bob Gibson, I'd like to turn this to you. What do you make of Virginia turning blue?
Well, the parties have to realize that the Virginia of today is not the Virginia of 10 and 20 years ago. They have to realize that there are tremendous numbers of Asian Americans and tremendous numbers of Latino Americans who are now very successful residents of Virginia. In fact, the Weldon Cooper Center from Sandy's report did a report earlier last year showing that the average incomes of these Asian Americans and Latino Americans living in Virginia is higher than the state average. So these are very successful new Virginia residents, and they have to be, three or four of the first 20 people applying to our political leadership programs for next year are Asian American. We're seeing increasing numbers of Latino and Asian American applicants for political leadership programs. I think it's going to be something that both parties had better pay close attention to.
Eddie from Lancaster, you actually want to chime in here as well. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm calling from a cell phone. I apologize if the service is not as good as it should be. I have a couple of concepts. One is the concept of redistricting, and then what kind of impact does that have in terms of perpetuating the reelection of the incumbent, essentially statewide? I guess that's the first supposition. And the other question, I guess, is doesn't redistricting in terms of the way that it is implemented tend to disenfranchise minorities in our state? Now, that's more of a question than a supposition, so I don't know. And I think the third point is, what about the whole business of the electorate experience? That is, when they're at the polls and when they have ballots, does the state do any testing with regard to the ballot prior to the election to see whether or not it is understandable, whether a large number of people can read and understand it? And I'll take my answers offline. Okay,
thank you so much. Jeff, do you want to take the redistricting discussion? We can make a whole show out of that.
Yes, I think we could probably talk about that for weeks. Redistricting, the way it works in this country and Virginia and most places, is that it is done under a system that is more or less partisan redistricting. And I say that if one party has control of all the levers of government, which in this redistricting cycle for us in Virginia, were the Republicans. They had the governorship, and they controlled both houses of the General Assembly. And so that meant that the maps that were produced for the the Democrats did have control of the state Senate when they did this, but they were in a very disadvantageous position. But in a lot of places, one party had complete control of the redistricting process, and essentially they got to choose their voters, the incumbents, whether it was the state Senate or it was the House of Delegates maps or if it was the congressional maps. And that happened all over the country. These gerrymandered, just incredibly ugly districts. You look at the congressional map of North Carolina, it's just these wiggly lines that don't make any sense, don't take any thought of communities of interest, just cut right through them to draw it in what is most politically advantageous way, because now in this day and age we have these great mapping technologies and we can look at, oh, how did this precinct go? And was it really Democratic? Was it really Republican? And we can pick and choose our constituents, essentially, if you're a map drawer for incumbents. And so in Virginia, for example, the congressional map that we ended up having, all the Republican districts, I mean, all the districts that were held by Republicans after 2010, eight of them, I'm pretty sure that every single one of them became more Republican, the district, at its base level, if you looked at the McCain-Obama vote from 2008. It became more Republican, and the three Democratic districts all became more Democratic, and it was in the service of keeping incumbents in place. And until we have fair redistricting, some kind of redistricting commission, we've seen that in Washington and in California and some other states, you're going to continue to see this kind of process.
So basically, partisan gridlock will prevent us from getting too far ahead in that issue.
Just, yes.
And just in the interest of addressing Eddie's last comment, testing the ballot to make sure it's legible, we touched on this earlier in the show. I love that he's brought that out. You know, why wouldn't there be oversight as to whether or not a ballot is easily read by all constituents? Anyone want to take that? It seems so common sense. Anita, maybe?
Well, I don't know how they test it, but I feel like the localities must have some, you know, it's not like they're just writing a ballot and having no one look at it. But, of course, I don't know who they have looking at it and how, you know, if they're making sure that everyone could understand it, can read it. And so maybe that's something that they'll have to look at. I can bet you right now that localities, the General Assembly, and even Congress are going to start taking a better look at voting issues, you know, in the next year or so after this election.
Nancy from Roanoke, go ahead with your question or comment.
Thank you. I'd like to comment, and this is not the purpose of my call, but I'd like to comment on the conversation that's going on now with regard to the language on the ballot, and we're talking about the amendments. That language is the language of the statute. If you change it so that it's more readable, more easily understood, then you have the issue of someone coming back and saying this is not the code itself does not match what I voted on. So there is an issue there. Until they start writing the laws in plain language, I don't know how you're going to resolve that.
Yeah.
But my true purpose of my call is that I've been listening to the show, and the focus is on what the government agencies are not doing or could be doing better. There's an opposite side to that coin. This is a democracy. This is a place where we get to say who we want for president or who we want in Congress. It's a governor of the people, by the people, for the people. The polls are open from 6 in the morning until 7 at night. There absolutely are some people who cannot get there within that time frame. But for most people, you can go before work or after work. You can get there. You can take your kids with you. People just need to get out and welcome the opportunity to have a say and get out there and vote without complaining and making excuses.
I think that is a wonderful way to end our program. It is about the voter making his or herself heard through that all-important vote. And I couldn't agree with you more. I want to thank all of our guests for being with us. First of all, I'll start off with Bob Gibson, who has pinched hit. I'm going to work on the past tense of that, and when I try that again. Bob Gibson,
executive. Thank you, Lily. I enjoy being on the show with you every time.
Me too. Executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Jeff Skelly, political analyst for the University of Virginia Center for Politics, who joins us from the Charlottesville studio of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. And Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, who has also just recently recuperated from her very, very grueling schedule. Thank you all for being with us. And, of course, thank you for joining us in today's conversation. It's about you, the listener, and we appreciate all of your input today. Next Friday at 9, a little culinary history from Virginia's colonial era. Next Friday on Virginia Conversations. I'm May Lily Lee. We'll see you then.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.